This is probably going to turn out less of a story and more like a confession. Only my ex-missus and a few close mates know about what I'm about to tell you. Otherwise, you'd never guess it just from looking at me. You'd think I was some boring, balding, church-going middle Englander whose pulse had never risen above 70 beats per minute. But for about 6 months back in the mid-1980s, I led quite a different life to the one I have now. You see, I just married my then-girlfriend and we were in the process of starting up a little family. And right when she was 3 months pregnant, Margaret Thatcher's Tory government decided to throw a spanner in the works. I lost my job, I was on the dole, I had a baby on the way and it was looking like we were going to lose the house. I tried my best to find a job that would meet our expenses, but it was almost impossible. And as time went by, I got increasingly desperate and increasingly depressed that I wasn't doing my job as the main breadwinner. Now, this is where Jib comes into the picture. Obviously, Jib isn't the real guy's name, and I don't reckon he'd appreciate me gobbing off about our mutual history, so I'll just use his old nickname that I don't imagine he goes by anymore. Me and Jib knew each other from secondary school, and although we weren't exactly best mates, we were still quite pally and led on to each other if ever we were out and about. So one day, I'm on my way back from the dole when I see Jib outside one of the local pubs. I say hiya, have a whinge about the lines of the dole, and turns out he was on his way into the pub, so he invites me in for a drink. I'm absolutely skinflint at this point. I didn't have two pennies to rub together after putting food in the cupboards, but as much as I politely decline him, he insists on getting me a few pints. The clincher for me was him saying, "You look dead stressed, mate. I reckon you deserve a pint." Never a truer word was said. First sip of the pint, it was like a wave of calm rushed over me. Not so much because of the ale, but because I realized it had been about 2 or 3 months since I'd actually sat down and drank a freshly pulled pint of lager. And let me tell you, I hadn't half missed it. Then when it comes to pay, Jib pulls out this proper wad of notes, all 20s as well, and immediately my mind is back on my money troubles. So obviously this seeps into conversation, and I end up telling him all about the redundancy, how the dole wasn't enough to get baby clothes, all my woes basically. Jib then gets out this little wad of notes, looks me in the eye and says, "How much do you need?" This is where I can hear a lot of you saying, "Why didn't you just take the money? Are you mental?" And you know what? You're right. I should have just swallowed my pride and taken his money, even if it made me feel pathetic. But that's just it, isn't it? Pride. People get weird when it comes to their ego, and for whatever reason, my ego just couldn't let me accept his charity. And even if loads of you don't get why I refused it, it doesn't really matter because Jib did. Jib saw that pride in me, and true to his nature, he saw an opportunity. You see, Jib came to remind me of an old war film my dad used to watch whenever it was on the telly. It's about this American prisoner in a Japanese POW camp who basically ends up running the place because he smuggles in whatever contraband people want. He gives people what they want and in turn, he uses that to manipulate them. This bloke ends up with the name King Rat. And let me tell you, Jib was King Rat. So instead of just offering me money, he offered me a job. He said he'd pay me £300 to pick up a car for him. Only trouble was is that he bought the car from a bloke in Bristol, so that meant getting the train down there so I could drive it back. For reference, £300 was a lot of money for what he was asking me to do, which amounted to maybe half a day's work at the most. I knew that there was a catch, that the car might be in a bad nick or, God forbid, it might be stolen. But I really wasn't in the position to be turning that kind of money down, especially when he said that if I got the car back in one piece, that there'd be more work in it for me. So, that's how I started working with, or more accurately, for, Jib. I thought he was a used car dealer. I really was that innocent. But after a couple of runs, he let me in on a little secret. The cars weren't the object of value in those little transactions. It was what was in them. I'd driven 4 different cars around various parts of the UK at that point, and not once had I realized that hollowed-out compartments in the doors had been stuffed with imported Moroccan hashish. What was I going to do? Kick off? Resign? I knew that there was a catch. I was just a bit annoyed that I hadn't been fully informed from the get-go. But then again, ignorance is bliss, isn't it? And Jib said that very same ignorance was like a superpower. I'd passed police cars countless times, and I even stopped to ask directions from one at one point, and at no point was I nervous or twitchy or anything else that might have alerted them to exactly what I was transporting. And on top of that, I was 26, going on 40. I look like a bloody PE teacher or something. You'd never suspect me. I'll admit that after that, I got way too comfy making the journeys. My doll disguise must have gotten in my head a bit, because when Jib offered me what amounted to a promotion, I jumped at the chance. On these new jobs, my pay would be about £650 a run, just over double the pay, and some of the trips would be to the next city over from us, an hour's driving time tops. It was a no-brainer. Half the work for double the pay. The only question was what I'd be transporting, and I'll never forget what Jib responded with when I asked him what would be in the cars. "Do you really want to know?" he said. No, I really didn't. As long as it wasn't a dead body in the boot or something equally as sinister, I really didn't want to know. So I started making these runs to a city relatively close by to us, 3 times a week. Getting the train out there, picking up a car from these Turkish blokes, and then driving it back home. And I was getting just shy of $2,000 a week for it. The wife was ecstatic. I was telling her the half-truth, that I was selling used cars with an old maid from school, and she was far too chuffed to ask any probing questions. But others did, and I ended up losing a couple of old workmates because they thought I was holding out on them, hoarding the wealth or something. But Jib had made me swear not to say a thing to anyone, and if I'd tried to get them in the door, he'd probably have dropped me like a live grenade. For 3 months, I worked that job, and the whole time, the cash was just rolling in. There was only ever one close call, too, when a traffic cop on a motorbike pulled me over for having a faulty brake light. When I brought it up with Jib, he assured me that every car would undergo a full MOT before I ever touched it. After that, there were no problems. I actually got quite pally with the Turkish blokes I picked the cars up from, too. They ran a little restaurant-slash-cafe type thing, and I used to pick the cars up from the delivery entrance around the back. The blokes would be sitting around this little table, chain-smoking ciggies and drinking this muddy-looking coffee. They'd say hello, shake my hand, sometimes offer me a coffee or one of their little syrupy pastries. Sometimes I'd partake, but mostly not. Then I'd take the keys off them, get in the car, and bugger off back home. Every single time, the restaurant would be buzzing. The shutters at the back would be open. It was a seamless transition of goods. Very subtle, but right in plain sight. There was never any fuss, never any serious danger. It was always the same routine. Which is why when I turned up at the Turkish place one Friday night and the place was closed, my spider senses started to tingle. I go around the back to see the shutters down, but it's not like I could have just said, "Oh well, it's closed. I'll have to just get the train home." There was a lot of money at stake. It's not like I could have just gone back empty-handed. People have been killed for losing smaller amounts of drugs than that. It's just assumed you've stolen it. So, I walk up to the shutters and I can hear someone talking on the other side. Brilliant, I think. The meat's still on. So I give the shutters a few knocks and wait for them to be opened. As soon as I knock, the voices go quiet, and then no one opens the shutters either. Again, my spider senses are tingling, so I take it upon myself to announce who it is, just in case they think I'm the police or something. As soon as I do, I hear someone fiddling with the shutters. Then they start to slide open before stopping at about 2 feet. Again, very weird, and it's just silent on the other side. I call out, "Hello," quite softly, using one of the Turkish bloke's names. All I hear is, "Come in," from the other side, so Doing as I'm asked, I crouch down to crawl under the shutter. Then, just as I emerge on the other side, someone kicks me in the face so hard it made my ears ring. All I can hear as I pick myself up is, "Get on your front. Lie down on your front," before someone starts kneeling in the small of my back. It's the police, I remember thinking. You absolute chucklehead. You've gone and got yourself caught red-handed, I thought to myself. Only when they didn't handcuff me, instead they started to dye my hands with something that I'd later learn was a kind of industrial strength sticky tape. My bell had been well and truly rang, but even in my punch-drunk haze, it hit me that there was something horribly wrong with the situation. And unless he was some undercover bloke forced to carry tape instead of cuffs or whatever, I might be in a lot more trouble than I first anticipated. Once my wrists, mouth, and ankles are taped up, the bloke then drags me to a corner of the stockroom, where I find he'd tied up and gagged the four Turkish blokes. Each of them has had the absolute senses beaten out of them, and my heart's racing as I get to thinking that I'm about to get the same treatment. But instead, he seems to just ignore me and resumes some kind of speech he must have been giving the Turkish blokes. And that's when it slowly became clear who it was. It wasn't the police. It wasn't even some other gang of drug dealers with some axe to grind. It was a vigilante. I won't repeat exactly what he said. It was quite a long, drawn-out, and terrifying affair, and I think every third word would be the F-word. And this is about to get obscene as it is, so I'll just sum it up at what he said. What he kept referencing was someone who died. I thought the Turks might have killed someone, and in a manner of speaking, I suppose they did. Because the bloke then lets on that it was his daughter that had died from heroin use, possibly of an overdose. But it could have been some other complication resulting from her addiction, he never specified. Then at one point, he started ranting about how you sell it, but you don't use it. And I suddenly see that there are these big, cling film wrapped packages on a table. The bloke must have arrived before they'd loaded the car up, and maybe even before the staff had arrived for the evening service. And all the evidence he needed that they'd sold heroin was right there for all to see. God knows how he found them, but he had. And for a long while, it didn't look like any of us were going to get out of there alive. The first thing he did was start cutting open some of the packages while he was on his sell it but don't use it rant. Then he starts trying to shovel it up some of the bloke's noses, working his way around until he actually tried doing it to me too. I thought I'd had it. Up some well times exhaling, cleaned my nostrils out as he moved back onto the other blokes in a frenzy. The whole time, I'm just terrified he's going to start using the knife in his hand, and that we're just seconds away from being slaughtered like sheep. But instead, he starts cutting the package wide open and dumping the contents all over us. He goes back for another, dumps the one on us, ranting and raving the whole time about how we're going to regret the day we're born. I just kept picturing the little girl I'd never get to see grow up. My ex-missus was less than a month from her due date, and the thought of her getting the news I'd been murdered was all I could think about. Not only that, but her finding out where I'd been getting the money from. That's what really got me. The shame she'd feel, and the secrets she'd have to keep from our daughter. I started to well up. I was so very, very out of my depth. I'd have given every bloody penny of that money back if I could just get back to my wife safely. And for the first time in my life, I actually prayed to God for literal salvation. Remember way back at the start when I said church going? This is why. The whole time I'm praying, I've got my eyes sealed shut. I couldn't bear to watch the vigilante bloke start stabbing, knowing he'd probably work his way through all four Turkish blokes before finally turning his attentions to me. But in the end, I had to open them. I just couldn't stop myself, and when I did, I saw that God had answered my prayers. One of the Turkish blokes had somehow, God only knows, managed to work one of his hands out of the tape. To this day, the only way I can see him managing it is if he was cursed or blessed with being extremely sweaty. But either way, I just watched as the vigilante turns his back on us to fetch another package before the Turkish bloke just launches himself at him. I didn't really get a good look at what followed. It just looked like a lot of squirming arms and legs from where I was lying, soundtracked by this manic cacophony of grunts and Turkish swear words. But eventually, the vigilante fella goes limp, and the Turkish fella rolls off of him, and he crawls over to cut us free. About a half an hour later, I'm sitting in a shuttered and empty Turkish restaurant, drinking this ultra-strong Turkish spirit and smoking my first ever cigarette. The Turk took my clothes off of me, I'm guessing to burn, so I was sat there in what was basically a waiter's uniform, just smoking and drinking until the shakes wore off. In the meantime, all kinds of different Turkish blokes turned up, presumably to deal with the vigilante's body and to clean everything down. By the time they let me back in the delivery room, it looked as good as new. Everything was clean and sparkly. The car had been wiped down. The fella had just been completely disappeared. Finally, about 3 hours after I arrived, I took the car keys and drove back home. When I arrived, I collected my wages and thanked him for the opportunity, but told him that that'd be my last delivery. When he asked why, I told him everything. And when I was done, he had to pick his jaw up off the floor. He ended up offering me a few hundred quid more on each run if I chose to carry on, but all I could think about was the moment I realized I might never see my kid grow up, and how no amount of money was worth risking that for. I ended up going back to university during my daughter's first few years, and I'm happy to say that by the time she'd mastered potty training, I was working in this newfangled field of information technology, a career choice that turned out to have a lot more longevity to it than I foolishly first anticipated. I retired this year, and I'm proud to say I have a few quid tucked away, at least enough to make myself comfortable. Me and the ex-missus are on good terms. I see my daughter and younger son a fair bit too, so can't complain there either. I'd like to think I've earned my twilight years, and I might sound a bit up myself here, but I think I'll appreciate them more than most, because I still remember a time in my life when things could have gone very differently, in more ways than one. And I remember how that horrible cycle of greed, suffering, and death just carries on rolling, sight unseen, forever and ever. I grew up in a place called Derry in Northern Ireland. You know that Norn Iron meme that's been going around? Hey, that's us. Anyway, I came up on a housing estate called Carn Hill. A wee bit rough, but generally in an alright place to live. Carn Hill is basically like 9 or 10 little clusters of houses on like a ring road, but all with lovely green spaces between them. You could run about them, play football, just generally messing about, you know, and most of the rest of the estates could see you, so your mum always knew someone was keeping an eye on you. Carn Hill took a lot of guff from the British Army during the Troubles, so naturally we had a big IRA presence here too. And when the violence ended, not all the paramilitaries decided to give up the cause. Not only that, but younger lads who glorified all that bollocks wanted a piece of it too, and so they joined continuity organizations like the Real IRA or Ogli na Héireann to carry on the fight. But who do you fight when there's no British soldiers around no more? You can't really go around shooting the police, because as much as we don't like to admit it, they do keep us safe from mad Huns when it suits them. So, who do you go for? Who are the enemies of the community? If you're a real IRA man, the answer is obvious. You go after drug dealers. And an even bigger prize, you go after those that predatorize children. Historically speaking, the IRA used to do most of their punishment beatings or shootings in the middle of the night and in the middle of nowhere. Seeing them be violent towards people who weren't outright Brits was bad PR, but after the continuity lot started targeting dealers and creeps, PR was a must-have. They wanted people to know that they were doing it, and they were proud of it. And what's most relevant to my story is that they wanted people to see it. So it's 2010, I'm 13 and I'm playing out with my friends during this lovely summer's evening. It's humid out, but with just the right amount of breeze, and I'm honestly dreading my mom calling me in for the night because I'm having such a good laugh. Normally she'd call me in, and I'd always manage to haggle a few more minutes out of her. It'd be this playful back and forth of 5 more minutes, mom, please, and hey, go on then, but here, make sure you're no longer than 5. The bath's running for you, so it is. Only this time, my name gets called, and when I give my usual pushback, it's immediate, like, Selena, get your backside in here right now, young lady. My mom didn't shout, she barked it. And she was about to go through me for a shortcut, and I knew she most definitely wasn't kidding on. I say bye to my friends, then notice all their mums are coming out too, calling them inside. I was only 13, but I wasn't soft, and I quickly worked out that mum was so agitated because 4 men had appeared on the green and were walking towards the wide open spot in the middle. As I reach my mom, she just tells me, go right up to your room and don't come out until I say. Now my bedroom faces street out the front and all the commotion was out the back, so I only half obeyed my mom by heading upstairs, but then creeping into my parents' bedroom at the back of the house so I could watch what was going on. As you just heard, the entire green was deserted except for 4 men. 2 were younger lads, 2 were a bit older. One of the older fellows had this terrified look on his face and was being flanked by the 2 young lads with their faces covered, who every so often had to kind of push him along like he was dragging his feet. It was clear he didn't want to be there, but I could only wonder as to what had him so spook like that. Anyway, right when the 4 men reached the middle of the green, they stopped. The older one at the back, who also had his face covered and was obviously the fellow in charge, started shouting all this stuff that I didn't quite understand at first. But then it became clear that the man they had with them had done something really bad, and it dawned on me that they were about to publicly punish him for it. But then, just when my sympathy for the man had reached its peak, the fellows with their faces covered said one of the few things I actually really understood, that the man they were about to punish was someone who had touched a child. I think that might have gotten a gasp out of just about everyone in the estate, and it completely shifted the dynamic of what we were witnessing. Because as much as what happened next was grim, I now understand that the real horror of what happened that day was that those men had the consent of the community to do what they did. Most people in Northern Ireland are tired of violence, but the vast majority of us, older and younger, just want to live our lives in peace. We've lived through more than 100 years of struggle, both north and south of the border, and if you can manage to elicit a bit of bloodlust from us, trust me, that's no mean feat. Then right before our eyes, the younger men forced their prisoner onto his stomach and held him in place while their leader took what looked like a gun out of one of his jacket pockets.
Then bang.
The man screamed like nothing I'd ever heard before. It was blood-curdling. I know that's cliched, but it's true. It was a sound I found myself physically recoiling from, and from what I understand, this first shot was to the back of the man's kneecap.
Bang.
Another shot, and another scream. The second sounded sadder than the first. I know that sounds weird, but it was more like a groan than a scream towards the end. Maybe he just didn't have the breath in his lungs anymore, who knows, but what's for certain is that this shot was to his other kneecap. He'd probably never walk properly again, not for the rest of his life, but I doubt that there was a single ounce of sympathy on their entire estate. I don't think they'd have flinched if they had blown his head off, but they didn't blow his head off. They shot something else off instead.
Bang.
Just when I thought I'd heard the most horrifying scream in my life, the third one tops it all. It was this undulating howl up and down and rasping at the end, that all you could hear was sobbing, this ugly sobbing as the masked men stood up and walked away. I don't really know what I was expecting to happen next. I mean, a man had just been shot 3 times. There could be little doubt that he was in danger of bleeding to death. You'd think someone in a good Christian community like ours would bother to check on him, regardless of the crime he'd been accused of. But no. It took half an hour for ambulance crews to reach us, and this isn't a place where the average response time is about 10 minutes. To me, that means people actually debated for a full 10 to 15 minutes whether or not they'd actually call for help for that guy. There were people on the estate who were happy to let the man die in front of their children that day, based on pure hearsay. Well, I say hearsay, but it did turn out to be true. The statement released by the PSNI condemned the way the man was attacked, but it didn't deny what he was. Lo and behold, the man, who will remain nameless here, was convicted of offenses just a year or so prior, and had moved over to Derry to start a new life. The paramilitaries tracked him down and told him to leave, and when he refused, they came for him. There's a lot of people, both at the time and now, who tell me they don't care if that guy was shot, how he got exactly what he deserved. And if he couldn't properly walk again, oh well, it meant our kids would be a wee bit safer. But I don't want to live in a place where that kind of violence is on view to the public. Civilized societies deal with their criminals without violence, and away from the innocent eyes of children. They shot that man because he abused children, but what's shooting someone in front of children, if not child abuse as well? I'm not trying to equate the two, don't get me wrong, but I'd like to think that monsters can only live on the fringes of society. And I don't think I could handle the realization that monsters are all around me, just pretending to be normal, regular people. When really, they're just as savage and brutal as those they profess to hate. I used to live in this really, really rough apartment block in an East Coast city that will remain nameless. I was pretty much forced to live there when I first started writing, as there was literally nowhere else within my budget, and it was honestly one of the best and simultaneously worst times of my life. The sense of community there was just second to none, and now that I live in a sterile apartment building where I barely know any of my neighbors' names, I kind of miss that. There was community barbecues in the summertime, some of the graffiti art was spectacular, and there was always something happening, be it good or bad. But if there was one single thing that made living there difficult, it was the drugs. As nice as the place could be, it was like a running battle with fiends and dealers to keep the place livable. At one point, the cops raided an apartment that was being used as a stash house, and an officer was shot in the line of duty. You think they might have come back stronger, show that they couldn't be intimidated, but the mayor seemed to have the opposite opinion. That basically leaving us to fend for ourselves was the answer. Over the course of one summer, the block went from a fairly nice, albeit cheap place to live, to an open-air drugs market. It was every bit the living nightmare that you might imagine. Sleep was at a premium. Dealers set a stereo system up in the middle of the courtyard and played music at all hours of the night. People were beaten up, robbed. Fiends were breaking into empty units and turning them into drug dens. They were leaving needles everywhere, too. It was the absolute worst, and people could only handle it for so long before something had to give. But at the time, you'd have to absolutely be crazy to stand up to a bunch of dope dealers.
Right.
Enter Shuley. Shuley looked to be in his 50s, but he took such little care of himself that he might not have been a day over 35. He smelled weird, he looked weird, he acted weird. And he was basically harmless. Essentially, Shuley was our resident crazy person. But I had no idea that Shuley would be crazy enough to actually stand up to those dope dealers in his own little way. Because one day, I hear this brand new sound coming from down in the courtyard. I was used to people shouting, music playing, and actually all manner of messed up new things since the dealers put up shop down there. But I'd never heard what sounded a lot like a handheld siren. I walk out of my apartment, looking over the balcony to see just what in God's name is going on, and I'm greeted by the sight of Shuley, holding up one of those megaphone things that evidently had a super annoying siren feature to it. He's aiming it at this little dope dealer, obviously too scared to actually confront him, but so sick of what's been going on that he couldn't stand to just sit in his apartment and wait for someone to kick the door in or whatever. He was like the littlest vigilante or something, a 5-foot-nothing Batman whose sole crime-fighting gadget was the power to irritate. Obviously, all the dope dealers did at first was laugh. Shuli looked objectively incredibly dumb, standing there trying to be all menacing with the silliest high-pitched wee-woo coming out of what was basically just a child's toy. It didn't take long before the noise started to get to them, and when they started not being able to hear their friend's orders properly, they chased Shuli back up the stairs and into his apartment. But then, he just started hanging over his balcony and blasting the noise at them, then just running back to his apartment when they ran up to beat him. It was kind of funny for a while. Annoying, yes, but no more annoying and considerably less depressing than what we normally heard. I'd long since taken to using headphones whenever I was in my apartment, so none of it made a difference to me, but after a while, Shuli's efforts did actually start to have an effect on the dope dealer's business. At least, we can only assume it had an effect on their business, because the next time I actually saw cops inside the apartment block was when they came to get Shuli's body. I was at work when it happened, but one of the dope dealers must have just snapped at some point and gone berserk. First thing I noticed was that all the fiends and dealers were gone, so I knew something weird was going on. That's when I saw the cops at Shuli's door. I had to walk past Shuli's apartment on the way up to my own, so as much as the cops tried to stop me at first, I had to insist on getting past in order to actually get home. Once I told them that, they relented and I managed to slip past the open apartment door to briefly get a look inside. I honestly didn't expect him to have been killed. Like, I know it sounds mean, but my first thought was like, "Ah, God, what's he been up to in there?" Thinking that he might have been up to some deviant act or something. But no. I saw the blood all over that apartment and I just did the math. I moved out like 3 months later. I was doing well enough at work that I could afford to be someone's roommate. That was a horror story on its own. And as much as I was sad that I had to leave, living somewhere where there had been a murder on the floor below was just a bridge too far for me. Drugs had just sucked the life out of that place. And I'm just glad that I got out of there before it got to me, too. Born in a relatively small family in the Indian city of Nagpur, Akul Yadav became something of a local menace as he grew older. As he entered his late teens, the miscreant child had graduated into a full-time criminal, and given how frighteningly intelligent the boy seemed to be, it wasn't long before he was running his own cartel of cruel and violent thugs. The gang ruled over the Kasturbar Nagar slum they called home, robbing, killing, and torturing all those who stood in their way, and with near impunity. After just a few years, Aku found he rarely needed to resort to violence anymore. The atmosphere of fear he and his underlings had cultivated meant he'd made most of his money from simple extortion, and he made weekly rounds to collect protection money that each small business owed him. That, and leaving dead bodies around the slum was a massive inconvenience for him. It meant he'd have to pay handsome bribes to local police officers to ensure his little fiefdom went untouched. Murder was bad for business. However, Aku found a form of punishment much more suited to his mode of operation. Indecent assault. As we've mentioned, murder was only likely to cause even more trouble for Aku and his gang. And part of their problem was figuring out how to effectively silence those who stood against them. A person could recover from a beating, one that would most likely just make them angry. But in India, as with many parts of the world, being the victim of an indecent assault can be a very stigmatizing event. Attack a woman in that manner, and she wouldn't breathe a word to anyone, and what's more, you effectively have something to hold over her, a piece of information one might use to manipulate and coerce. It's a form of terrorism that Aku employed on a yearly basis, and those who fell victim to it had absolutely no form of legal recourse. Handsome police bribes ensured that no investigation would be opened, allowing Aku and his minions to rob, assault, and intimidate at will. Some Kasturba Nagar residents said that every single shack or cramped apartment in the entire slum housed some victim of Aku's horrifying malice, the youngest of which was a 10-year-old girl. In one incident, Aku personally took the life of a woman named Asha Bai. "We were eating dinner when he came to the front door and pretended to be a friend of my brother," said Asha's daughter. "When my mother opened the door, he dragged her out and stabbed her. He then cut off her ears for her earrings and her fingers because he could not get her rings." Asha's mother, a woman named Anjana Bai Bukhar, was also forced to witness her death. Another woman described how she and her husband were attacked by Aku in the middle of the night. "He arrived at our house at around 4 or 5 in the morning, banging loudly on the door and telling us he was from the police. When my husband opened the door, Aku stabbed him in the thigh, almost completely immobilizing him. Then, in full view of my husband, Aku violated me over and over again, until long after the sun had risen." The number of accounts like that are seemingly endless, with some of the worst describing how Aku defiled women in the hours after they were married, or how he cut off another's chest after her daughter was unable to pay her protection money. But perhaps the worst account is the story of how Aku carnally violated a woman just 10 days after she'd given birth. The shame was too much for her, and as a result, the woman marched into a bustling marketplace, doused herself in kerosene, then set herself on fire. Finally, after years of terrorizing the Kasturbar Nagar slums, the police decided that Aku's iron-fisted rule had to be curtailed. Numerous attempts to ban him from the area, including being detained for over a year under emergency powers, was completely ineffective. Aku simply delegated to his lieutenants who still operated in the slums or ignored the rulings entirely. What's more, Aku had found a way to kill and maim with complete impunity by targeting the minority communities known as Dalits. With their name rooted in the Sanskrit word for broken, the Dalits belong to those inhabiting the lowest caste in Indian society and are often known simply as the Untouchables. They are subjected to some horrendous forms of bigotry, and according to a 2007 report by International Human Rights Watch, the treatment of Dalits is India's hidden apartheid, and that the Dalits endure segregation in housing, schools, and access to public services. Needless to say, the police weren't so interested in investigating crimes committed against the Dalits. They didn't even ask for bribes to keep them quiet. Yet what's clear is that, despite the fear Aku had instilled in the Kasturbar Nagar slums, the people could only take so much abuse before they began to lash out. And it seems that any serious and organized resistance began with a woman named Usha Narayani. You see, Usha refused to be intimidated by Aku and his goons, and continually demanded that local police take action against him on her behalf. Every single day she called by to check if her complaints were being dealt with, and each time, she took her indignation further and further up the chain of command. But instead of actually dealing with her complaint, the police warned Aku that Usha was causing trouble for them and needed to be dealt with. And so, that night, Aku and 40 of his most brutal foot soldiers surrounded Usha's home and demanded she come out. It was reported that Aku carried only one weapon, a bottle of sulfuric acid, and told Usha if she merely withdrew her police report, that everything would be fine. She refused. Aku then began to bark out, "I'll throw acid on your face, and you won't be in a position to file any more complaints. If we ever meet you, you don't know what we'll do to you. Being violated is nothing compared to what we'll have in store. You hear me? Nothing. We'll burn you alive, cut you into pieces, and then feed you to stray dogs." Yet, instead of kowtowing to such threats, Usha began to barricade the doors to her home. This only infuriated the criminals, who made short work of the barricades and forced their way into the house. However, once they were inside, a frighteningly familiar smell graced their nostrils. It was the smell of gas, and standing before them, box of matches in hand, was Usha Narayani. "Get out of my house, or I will burn us all," she growled. And for the first time in a long time, Aku was the one who was terrified. They were forced to abandon the attack, but Aku obviously didn't take the defeat well, and began to plot a terrible revenge against the woman who had so embarrassed him. The next day, news of Usha's successful defiance spread like wildfire among the Kasturba Nagar slums. Many celebrated, but many also saw it as an opportunity to make even further gains from Aku and his men. Dalits flooded the streets, armed with sticks and stones, and began to attack Aku's lieutenants on sight. Then, on August 6th of 2004, a group of furious Dalits closed in on Aku's lavish house on the edge of the slums. They smashed their way inside, chased away the guards, looted the place, and then put it to the torch. The cheers and celebratory singing could be heard for miles around. Aku was on the run, and in a hilariously hypocritical twist, he turned to the police to protect him from the mob. And it's while he's in police custody that those wishing retribution against him began to make their moves. Aku was held in one single static location, a location known to thousands of Kasturbar Nagar residents. And on the 13th of August 2004, they made their move. After hearing that Aku was about to be released after a corrupt bail hearing, hundreds of angry women marched down to the courthouse that Aku was being held at. At first, their gathering appeared to be a furious but relatively peaceful protest, and police even allowed a few of the women into the courtroom to bear witness to bail hearing, having assured them that it would be fair and impartial. Yet when Aku appeared in the courtroom at around 2:30 p.m., he was arrogant, disrespectful, and entirely unrepentant. When one woman took the stand to accuse him of violating her, Aku laughed out loud, mocking her and saying he'd do it again if he could. This elicited laughter from a few of the police officers in attendance. Some say the laughter was in response to how immature Aku was acting. But what's clear is that to the women on the stand, as well as those in attendance, the laughter was the final straw. One woman launched herself at Aku, taking off her sandal and striking him about the head with it. Officers of the court tried to restore order, and the sight of them protecting the very man who had terrorized them for so long sent the women into a frenzy. Yet what followed wasn't outright chaos, so much as orchestrated chaos. The women of Kasturba Nagar hadn't just shown up that day on a whim. Oh no, they had a plan. A plan that was perhaps as simple as it was effective. You see, the women who showed up to the court that day did so concealing all manner of bladed articles. They knew well that the Nagpur courthouse had metal detectors, ones that would easily reveal any kitchen knives or other steel weapons they tried to smuggle in. To get around that, the women of Kasturba Nagar had conspired to start something of a cottage industry, one focused solely on the production of what we might call prison shanks. They made knives out of plastic, out of wood, out of glass, and when they ran out of material, they made knives out of sharpened pieces of rock. But in addition to these deadly homemade blades, the women carried small baggies of what would prove to be a surprisingly effective non-lethal weapon, chili powder. So when the officers of the court moved to restrain them, all it took was one handful of chili powder blown into a cop's eyes, and he was out of the fight. Once all of the officers protected him had been incapacitated, Aku was no longer the cocky, gloating figure he'd been just minutes before. Instead, he begged for his life. "Forgive me, please," he said to have wailed. "I won't hurt anyone anymore. I'll leave Nagpur for good. None of you will ever hear from me again. Just please don't kill me." A single woman approached him, and the room fell silent. It was Anjana Bai Bukhar, whose daughter had been murdered by Aku before her very eyes. "Aku, Yadav, she began, we can't both live on this earth together. It's either you or us. And with that, the attack began in earnest. It's thought that Aku Yadav was stabbed by almost 400 women that day as he lay helpless on the marble floor of the Nagpur courtroom. They had agreed to all stab him at least once, plunging the blades into his body before passing them on to the next woman. The women poured the remainder of the chili powder into his eyes and up his nostrils, while one began to slice off his reproductive organs before holding them above her head like a bloody trophy. Some say it took Aku at least 30 minutes to actually expire, and when he was dead, the entirety of the courtroom's bright white marble flooring was soaked in his blood. The man himself lay dead from literally hundreds of stab wounds, at just 32 years of age. When the attack was finished, the women of Kosturbar Nagar returned to their husbands and fathers to tell them that they had killed Aku Yadav. The entire slum seemed to burst into celebration. That night, families blasted out music into the streets, dancing and cheering in pure jubilation. Households gifted fruit and food to their neighbors, a tradition normally associated with the holiest of Hindu holidays. The police honed in on the woman who had given birth to the resistance, the same woman who had flooded her own house with gas before threatened to roast Aku and herself alive. Usha Narayani was arrested and charged with murder, but a crowd of 400 women and more than 100 men and children gathered at the courthouse, each saying that they were the ones solely responsible for Aku's murder. And as a result, no one could be charged, and in 2012, Usha was officially acquitted of all charges. Retired Indian High Court Judge Bahav Vahani publicly defended the woman who lynched Yadav, saying that, in the circumstance they underwent, they were left with no alternative but to finish Aku. The women repeatedly pleaded with the police for their security, but the police failed to protect them. If they took law into their own hands, it was because the law and law enforcing agencies had not given them succor. Some did attempt to condemn the murder, saying that extrajudicial killings were completely unacceptable. And as much as they're legally and morally correct, there's no denying that the women of Kosturba Nagar were only capable of taking a certain amount of abuse before they decided to lash out and wreak a terrible retribution. And in the case of Aku Yadav, that retribution came in the form of an agonizing, terrifying, and drawn-out death, and arguably, one that he very much deserved. I'm from a little place called Gosport, a small town that's a few miles outside of Portsmouth, which you might actually have heard of. It's about the last place you'd think of having an active vigilante, but back in 2006, we actually had one. All right, he wasn't Charlie Bronson and Death Wish or anything, but he definitely spooked a lot of people who just so happened to be breaking the law, and I had a neighbor who was one of them. One day, my neighbor wakes up, has a shower, has his brekkie, then heads out to his car to go to work. It's then that he happens to see a piece of paper tucked under his windshield wiper, so naturally, he goes over to see what it says. Lo and behold, using cut-out newspaper letters like it's a 40s noir detective film, the note just says, "Warning, you have been seen using your mobile phone." Bizarre, isn't it? Until you understand that it's actually referring to them using their phone while driving. This is actually against the law here in the UK, and I'd be surprised if it wasn't in the US too, as I imagine it can cause a lot of accidents. Obviously, my neighbor is a little bit embarrassed, but otherwise just screws the paper up, lashes it in his bin, and dismisses the person as some weird nosy Parker. That's when they noticed the tires. All four had been slashed, and he would most definitely not be making it to work on time that morning. And this didn't just happen the one time either. This mysterious person repeated the act of slashing tires and leaving notes on more than 20 different cars. Apparently one of the women didn't even own a mobile phone and that she was furious that she'd been targeted to begin with. But between you and me, I reckon that's a load of tosh. Everyone and his dog has a mobile, even back in 2006, and our little town is quite well off, if I say so myself, so it's not like anyone's struggling. We know each other's business, too. Can't help talking in a small town like ours. You see things, too, all sorts of things. But it seems like one of us is a little bit more observant and indignant than the others. If I'm honest, I like that there's people out there willing to step up and defend what's right. But the weird note and the knife, that's making the whole thing a bit frightening, don't you think? Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. If you got a story, be sure to submit them to my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations for just $1 a month on Patreon, and maybe even pick up some Let's Read merch on Spreadshirt. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all these stories in huge compilations and save huge on data. Located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links down below. Thanks so much, friends, and I'll see you again soon.